woman is the beginning of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Woman is the beginning of the world. Think about it. Do something about it. We make her paint her face and dance. If she won't be a slave, we say that she don't love us. If she's real, we say she's trying to be a man. By putting her down, we pretend so hard that she's above us. Woman is the neck of the world. Yes, she is. You don't believe me? Take a look at the one you're with. Woman is the slave of the slave. Ah, yeah. If you believe me, you better scream about it.
John Lennon with "Woman Is the End of the World," a song I couldn't think of a better song to open up this show with, and especially the first segment, but all throughout the show, that's a central issue, the position and status of women in the world today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with David Heilbronner, who's one of the directors of Waiting for Armageddon. It's a fascinating and terrifying documentary that's out about millions of evangelical Christians who are actively pursuing Armageddon. Okay, this is kind of, In the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Betty Claremont, the author of The Neo-Catholics, Implementing Christian Nationalism in America, a fascinating book about the rise of the Neo-Catholics and the rise of Christian nationalism and what it means, what it pretends for the rest of the world and the future. But opening the show up is a segment I've been really, really have some intense feelings about, and something that a lot of people who listen to the show regularly know. I'm not a major sports fan. I probably should be, but I'm not. I appreciate the beauty of sports in terms of human potential and the rest of this stuff. On the other hand, I don't spend a lot of time watching it. So some things escape me. But the other day, I was looking in the newspaper and saw this article about CBS defending its decision to run an ad. And what they said was the Tim Tebow ad during the Super Bowl. And as it turns out, with a little bit of investigation, it's an anti-abortion ad. And it was just totally outrageous. And then I happened to go to the website, RH Reality Check, and found an article by my guest for this segment of the show, Amanda Marcotte. And Amanda writes for the blogs Pandagon and RH Reality Check, and she's the author of the book, It's a Jungle Out There, The Feminist Survival Guide to Politically Inhospitable Environments. And Amanda wrote a very compelling piece on what's going on with this Super Bowl anti-abortion ad. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. All right, so I just gave a very sketchy outline of this ad. If you want to fill it out any, and then tell me, what's your problem? What the hell's the matter with you? Why do you oppose this ad?
Well, the ad is basically, well, actually, technically nobody knows for sure what's in the ad because it hasn't aired yet, but the assumption is that it's going to be a retelling of a story that Tim Tebow, who is the quarterback for the Florida Gators, mother tells as part of her Christian ministry about how she was a missionary in the Philippines when she was pregnant with Tim, and she had amoebic dysentery, I think it was, and it caused potential problems with the pregnancy. Supposedly the doctors suggested that she get an abortion to save her health and because the potential for the fetus being for birth defects and other things like that. She said no. She had the baby anyway, and he became a Heisman winner. So I guess the implication is that no one, and the implication, I don't guess, I know that the implication from Focus on Family, who's funding the ad, is that abortion should be banned because, hey, Heisman winners.
Amanda, we got to start off with this. My mother called me last night, okay? And She said that she was very, very disappointed. She felt cheated, and she just wanted to notify me that she was sending me back. Because she decided to have me a long time ago, and I didn't become a Heisman Trophy winner. I don't play football. I haven't really given her much to brag about. So she's sending me back, and it's all because of this damn ad, okay?
Maybe she should have gotten amoebic dysentery while pregnant with you.
Right, yeah. You know, one thing about this ad is funded by Focus on the Family. You know, one of the reasons to actually be very suspicious of what they're saying around that, what's going to be in this ad, is actually the fact that Focus on the Family is one of these Christian fascist anti-abortion, anti-women groups. That's a big part of their agenda, is really the subjugation of women.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me, and that's kind of what I was like writing my article about, that the organizations like Focus on Family, like their ideal role for women is to be seen and not heard, but in order to kind of create these ads that and these stories that promote their view that abortion is wrong, they have to actually put women front and center talking about choices they've made. So I feel like they kind of undermine their own viewpoint by making Pam Tebow, which is the name of Tim Tebow's mother, out to be this big hero, when really at the end of the day, they just want women like her to mostly just reproduce and shut up.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Amanda Marcott from RHRealityCheck.org about the Super Bowl anti-abortion ad.
I was talking to somebody last night, and even the fact that I get what you're saying about this, they're actually saying that this woman had a choice, and nobody's saying that every woman, when pregnant, has to agree, get an abortion. It is a question of a woman has to have the right to choose what to do with her body. And whether she wants to carry a fetus to term or not to term. It's a fetus. It's not a potential Heisman Trophy winner. It could be a potential Ted Bundy, too, frankly, and which is that's an interesting little thought there. But the thing is that there is this point of really, if imagine if you were to say, okay, well, CBS, you still have some ad space open. I'm going to put an ad on that has 25 women, 100 women all saying, I had an abortion and I never regretted it for a minute. Imagine what would happen there.
You know, it's an interesting question, and a lot of people are asking, why doesn't the pro-choice community do that? Why not buy an ad space and say something like, I'm glad that Tim Tebow's mom had a choice. Why shouldn't all women have a choice? Or like what you said, I had an abortion, and I also didn't regret my decision. And the reason is that an ad space for the Super Bowl costs $2.5 million. I think that kind of finishes. I don't even know if CBS, if somebody could scrape together $2.5 million between now and Sunday and get that ad made, it would be awesome, because apparently CBS is still selling ad space for the Super Bowl. I don't know if they would take it. I don't know if they would. I actually suspect that instead of running an ad like that, they would just simply cut both ads.
Yeah, well,
block both ads.
Well, it's interesting, because I would tend to think that actually they might just tell you, sorry, we're not running yours. I mean, it's very interesting that they did this thing. Just as background information, CBS has argued continuously that they have a policy against advocacy ads. And they, in fact, refused to run an ad around gay marriage. They refused to run ads around PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And now all of a sudden, they come up and they say, well, our policy has evolved, although I did also see a recent memo from CBS that said they meant to say, not evolved, they meant to say that our policy has been intelligently designed in a way that we could. And I'm saying that jokingly, but, you know, that's the direction of things, because this thing of the ad, the cost of the ad, I mean, Focus on the Family didn't have the money either, but there were some people, some very powerful forces who threw together the $2.5, $2.7 million to get this ad financed. And CBS actually, their policy changed in relation to this ad.
It did. Now, the interesting thing is, last year, a group called CatholicVoter.org also tried to purchase an ad that was basically the same message as this one, which is, except it was focused on Barack Obama suggesting that he could have been aborted if it was legal. So there's no evidence to suggest that his mother didn't want to have him. And it got turned down because of their anti-advocacy position. So I don't know why they changed that. And I think part of it is that last year they got so much harassment over not running the anti-abortion ad that they've just decided that it's not worth it, if that makes any sense.
Well, let me ask you this. You have a situation now where at the same time as all this is building up around the Super Bowl and all this stuff is happening around this ad, you have, and really, we have to look at this in terms of the content of this ad and the whole fact that this anti-abortion message is going to be getting out in a huge way to 100 million people. And you think about what that's going to do in terms of a rallying poll. And then you have the trial of Roeder, the guy that killed Dr. Tiller, going on. and all the attention that's being focused on that and all the ideas that, well, he actually, you know, the argument that's being made in his case of it was justifiable homicide because this is a man that was killing babies. You know, and you think about now what's going on with
that. Did you hear that they just handed down the verdict, though?
No, I didn't. What was the verdict?
Guilty of premeditated murder in the first degree, guilty mm-hmm. of two aggravated assault counts. So he's going to go away for life. So at least there's that good news.
Yeah, that's true. At the same time, I'll bet you anything, it doesn't change the thrust of what I'm getting at, which is his defenders will be rallying around that as yet another victimization of people fighting God's battle for life. You know, I'll bet you anything.
Sure of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one thing you asked was a question of what does football have to do? What does abortion have to do with football? How'd you answer that? Besides robbing us of Heisman Trophy winners, okay?
It's kind of interesting. The religious right has really, 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 really wants sports to be kind of about them. And they really feel like the very macho sports culture should be a perfect fit for their viewpoint. And I think, you know, a lot of people kind of agree. There's certainly a whole lot of very, like, conservative religious people in sports. But, you know, it's certainly not universal. And a lot of the sports fan base and a lot of sports journalists I've seen really, really hate this attempt to politicize, you know, to basically attack women's rights using, like, football as a cover. They're like, I just want to watch some football. I don't really want to get engaged in this whole notion that, you know, because you like this macho sport, then you're a natural audience for agreeing that women shouldn't have, like, their basic human rights. So it's been an interesting struggle because I think that the people that are kind of pro-choice in the sports world, their attitude has been mostly, like, shut it down. I don't even want to discuss it. And it would be nice to see more people that were into sports actually, like, saying, like, just because you like football, just because you like basketball doesn't mean that you're a macho, you know, POS that you can actually support women's rights openly instead of just, you know, wish that it would all go away.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, part of the thing is I think that the idea of the way that they present football and even all these sports where apparently this I'm an atheist and this thing of this supposed God is in there rigging things up so-and-so can get a touchdown, so-and-so can win this baseball game or basketball game or whatever. And then the insane holy roller wiggling that goes on in the end zones after touchdowns and pointing to the sky and all this. But there's this whole thing that's really bound up with exactly what you're saying, the status of women, the patriarchy and the status and subjugation of women is really bound up in that aspect of what's being promoted in sports these days.
Yeah, and the more religious it gets, the more disturbing that kind of thing is. Because, you know, the old-fashioned sexism of sports, while annoying, was, like, you know, kind of the silly, like, okay, women are for looking at, they're cheerleaders, they don't know anything about football, condescension. But certainly wasn't about, like, women shouldn't have the basic right to decide when they give birth. And, you know, now you're seeing more of that going on, and it's scary. And really, from the religious rights perspective, what they're trying to do is mainstream their culture. So they really get behind and give a lot of support to people like Tim Tebow and other religious right types that are getting into sports because they see that as the way that they're legitimized in mainstream American society because there's nothing more mainstream than football. Mm-hmm. In American society. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Amanda Marcotte from RHRealityCheck.org about the Super Bowl anti-abortion ad.
I thought it'd be interesting to point out, too, is that there have been a few holes that have begun to appear in Tim Tebow's mom's story, too, which I thought was actually very interesting. Are you familiar with the way that seems to be unraveling?
Yes. There's two big ones. First of all, she was living in the Philippines when she supposedly was advised to get an abortion. In the Philippines, it is and has been illegal for a long time for women to get abortions under any circumstances whatsoever. It's a very Catholic country. So if her doctors really did suggest an abortion, they were doing so against the law, which casts some doubt on her story. And then the second thing is that she has made a big deal out of how her own life was threatened. But there is reason to believe that what was specifically wrong with her pregnancy was only a threat to the fetus's health, not necessarily hers, especially since she had round-the-clock care. So those are the big holes. To my mind, the interesting one is the story about the Philippines, because while she was pregnant, she was living in a country that has exactly the kind of laws that Focus on Family wants America to have. And yet, you know, what they're basically tacitly admitting is that abortion happens anyway. So why ban it, except that it just makes it dirtier and more dangerous?
Exactly. One other question. There's also been a tremendous response around this ad. Can you talk a little bit about the campaign that's going on? What's the people, the groups that have been mobilized, the campaign that's going on to oppose this?
Yes. NARAL, NOW, all these major feminist organizations, Center for Reproductive Rights, have all taken the position that CBS should not run this ad because it's inconsistent with their previous policy on advocacy. And that's been tremendous for them. They've gotten a ton of response, tons of petition signatures sent to CBS. I think that it's probably going to be ineffective, but at least they've drawn some attention to the fact that, you know, contrary to the way that swing nuts act like they're so victimized by the mainstream culture, in fact, they're coddled and are allowed to break the rules that everyone else has to live by, you know, in this case. So I think that's been really interesting. I do wish that the major feminist organizations took the time more often to point out that Pam Tebow is being celebrated for having and making a choice, and that we should celebrate that women can make choices and not, if that makes any sense. I feel like that would almost be a more productive way to go at that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I mean, I understand where you're coming from and I agree with it to a degree, but I'll tell you, what gets me is actually, one, when I look out and see that the response of all the major women's organizations around, and frankly of all organizations, but particularly some women's organizations around this assault on abortion has not been commensurate with the immensity of the assault. And this has been something that's really been bugging the hell out of me. The fact that the right mobilizes, I mean, look, like I said, they're getting this ad out to 100 million people, and they can mobilize, you know, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people in support of banning abortion. And yet we are still constrained by the idea. Look, a lot of people won't even use the word abortion. A woman's right to abortion, to me, is a very basic human right. And we need to start saying no. We're going to use the term abortion, and we're not going to settle for just like something lower than that. If a woman doesn't have the right to an abortion, she's essentially enslaved. That's where I'm coming from on this.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I've always been against the wishy-washiness. And you know, really at the end of the day, what I think causes the sort of, there's, you know, two reasons. One, they just have more money than we do to spend on propaganda, and that's just all there is to it. And two, I think the pro-choice side can get a little wishy-washy because what we're talking about at the end of the day is sex. And it's a little, you know, this country's still very puritanical, very backwards on the issue. And so it's a lot easier to mobilize people around the kind of idea that sex is kind of gross and it needs to be controlled and punished. And a little harder to get people to be out front being like holding a sign and saying, you know, I want the right to have sex and control my body and you can just buzz off. And, you know, also it's easier to mobilize people for change, whereas the feminist side in theory is defending the status quo on legal rights. A lot of people think that Roe versus Wade is in no danger, that it's established law, but of course, as the court recently demonstrated, they don't necessarily care what established law is.
Right. And frankly, a woman's right to an abortion concentrates a whole hell of a lot of the heart of the assault that the right is waging against the people and against women in particular. I mean, we have to wrap this up now, but, you know, something to really, I think about and start popularizing. And then you can call me, tell me how the response you're getting. How about we just go out to people and say, you know what, abortion on demand and without apology. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Free abortion on demand and without apology.
There you go. All right, Amanda, thank you very much for joining us today. And people can read your article on the website. What's the website? rhrealitycheck.org?
It's .org.
And then your Pandagon, how can they find that?
That's pandagon.net.
Okay.
Pandagon like the Pentagon.
Okay, got it. And it's a panda. Okay. All right, Amanda, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Amanda Marcotte of RHRealityCheck.org about the CBS television network airing an anti-abortion commercial during the Super Bowl, an ad bought and paid for by the Christian fascist group Focus on the Family. And along with that, we've been talking about the need for all people to stand up in defense of abortion, understanding that abortion is not murder, fetuses are not babies, and women are not incubators. Free abortions on demand and without apology. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Betty Claremont, the author of a fascinating new book, The Neo-Catholics, Implementing Christian Nationalism in America. Welcome back. That's I Don't Want to Be No Catholic Boy by the Dead Boys. A little bit later on the show, we're going to be talking with David Heilbroner, one of the directors of the new documentary Waiting for Armageddon. But before we do that, I am really pleased to welcome to the show Betty Claremont, author of The Neo-Catholics, Implementing Christian Nationalism in America from Clarity Press. This is a fascinating book. It's just chock full of all kinds of information. I'm going to jump right into the interview because I want to have as much time as I can get talking with Betty. Betty, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this. Define, first of all, I mean, when I saw Neo-Catholics, and you're talking to somebody who grew up, went to 16 years of Catholic school, abandoned it, but, you know, when I saw the term Neo-Catholics, I thought, now, what the hell is a Neo-Catholic? So can you define first in the beginning Neo-Catholics and Christian nationalism?
Well, Neo-Catholics is just a contraction of neoconservative Catholics, that's all. And implementing Christian nationalism, that's the religion that the neoconservatives have tried to impose on this country, making it a theocracy, in fact.
For me, I mean, that's one of the things that really comes out very strongly in your book, and we'll get into some of the particulars around it. But one of the things, just starting off, that you also pay a lot of attention to, and I wanted to get it out of the way, and maybe we can come back to it later, if time allows, you raised from the very beginning an organization called Opus Dei. And I think a lot of people are just, you know, they maybe from the Da Vinci Code and Mel Gibson's Insanity, they've had some of this stuff of some vague notion of Opus Dei, but you actually have put that in many ways as sort of the hands behind the throne, the Wizard of Oz, you know, that's behind the curtain and stuff. So what is Opus Dei?
Opus Dei, as the book mentions, was founded in 1928 by its founder, a conservative, both politically and religious conservative man, and it's about power. It's about money buying power, and they wish to buy this power through the Catholic Church, controlling the Vatican.
Now, an aspect of that, too, though, I mean, it's very interesting because these Opus Dei actually has drawn in, it seems, many very powerful and influential people. I was surprised about the influence, including the people that are in these Neo-Catholics. A lot of the key people in that actually are hooked up with Opus Dei.
That's correct. And they're hooked up, as I said, through power. In other words, they're attracted to a powerful organization, and the organization wishes to recruit powerful people.
One of the things that you bring out, too, which, again, I think may surprise a lot of people, I remember when I was living in D.C. and I was doing a lot of writing around Africa, and I would find things like the Georgetown, the CSIS, and then the Heritage Foundation, and many other groups. One of the things that you point out in your book is that actually these neo-Catholics, many of the institutions of conservatives and the neoconservatives are bound up with this core of neo-Catholics.
Well, that's the reason, actually the reason why I wrote the book, is that when people think of the religious right, often they think of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson. But the point of the book is that it was actually Catholics were the progenitors of the religious right in this country. They were the intellectuals, they were the money people, they were the steering of the religious right.
Give people a sense of who some of those people were.
Well, the book concentrates on Paul Weyrich, who was connected with the Coors baron, Joseph Coors, funded by Joseph Coors. And it was Weyrich, who is a Catholic, who founded the Heritage Foundation and founded the Moral Majority. It wasn't Protestants. It was Catholics that started the ball rolling. But it's also Catholics who had the experience in theocracy and the international connections to get the ball rolling.
The other aspect of this, though, is that, like you're saying, it was actually Catholics who began a lot of this. But there was a real, and you do a wonderful job of documenting this, there was a real effort to form a religious right. You had the Protestant evangelicals on one side, you had, and like you said, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, all these people who, you know, were out there in various ways, Jimmy Swaggart, all these people who were coming and going, and we had Rob Boston on just last week, who talked about for a large part of the 90s, and for the large part of the 80s and 90s, Pat Robertson was actually what he considered the most dangerous man in America. And still today, when this man makes insane, inane comments, the media is all over it, and they're promoting it, and the guy is still sort of like a godfather of the Christian fundamentalist lunatic fringe. And they're not even a lunatic fringe, because as our next guest on Waiting for Armageddon talks about, there's actually 50 million people in this country who believe, at least 50 million people, who believe in a literal reading of the Bible. You know, but you actually make a point that there was an effort to weave together the Christian evangelicals with the neo-Catholics in order to build this Christian nationalism. Can you talk about that some?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. In other words, Catholics as a denomination is the largest single denomination in this country, but they're not 50% of the population. So in other words, in order to elect neoconservatives, they needed a coalition of Catholics and evangelicals to make a 40% majority, and then the other 10% would be the wealthy people who benefit from it. You know, Dick Cheney's 50+1 mm-hmm. of the electorate.
Now, they had some contradictions in doing this, though, I would think. I mean, because, you know, there's, like I said, you know, having grown up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood and in other neighborhoods around us, and we were always called, believe it or not, and you know, and I'm not 100 years old, we were always called papes and papists.
That's correct.
Yeah, and we were always fed the idea, you know, with Kennedy being elected, that this was a major blow against oppression and Catholics were really victimized in the world. And it seemed that there would be some kind of, there were contradictions between these Protestant evangelicals and neo-Catholics or Catholics. What were those contradictions and how did they resolve them?
Well, that's part of the brilliance of the religious right, is that they were able to overcome these more than generational. I mean, it's a historical animosity between Catholics and Protestants. Protestants, by definition, protested the Catholic Church. And American evangelicals were even more anti-Catholic than their European counterparts. So that was part of the genius of what they were able to accomplish.
But in doing that, in overcoming some of these contradictions, they also had to, you point out that there were certain issues that they had in common, that they forged a deep unity around. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, because one of them is the state of Israel, but the other is, and this figures largely throughout the rest of your book, is the issue of abortion.
Absolutely. If any of your listeners out there are old enough to remember, there was a time in this country when no one actually spoke about abortion much, when it wasn't an issue. Even after Roe v. Wade was promulgated in 73, no candidate ran on an abortion issue. It was totally a construct of the neoconservatives that elections should be decided and settled on an issue like abortion. But it also, as I mentioned in the book, it's convenient, certainly for Catholic prelates and hierarchs who are bachelors, to choose an issue that they could never be accused of. And by the same token, you have evangelical leaders who, no matter what the Supreme Court decides, will always have the money for their own wives and girlfriends to go to clinics and have abortions. So it was a natural issue to bring up and to build this movement around.
Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Betty Claremont, the author of The Neo-Catholics Implementing Christian Nationalism in America, put out from Clarity Press, a fascinating book. Now, Betty, it seems like the overall melding of the political programs and the political and ideological stuff around the neocons and the Protestant evangelicals and the neo-Catholics, this question of actually the subjugation of women seems to play huge in this, and the absolutism involved that really gets called up a lot around the abortion question, including, I know you said in your book that actually a lot of the Catholic stuff had to actually, even in terms of weaving and building this religious right, the Catholics actually had to adjust some things. For instance, they had to get into, well, how come these people we're uniting with, they say they're pro-life, but they'd have no problem with war and the death penalty.
Well, I also mentioned in the book, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, L-A-K-O-F-F, Lakoff, Lack. I think he did an excellent job of describing what the conservative mind or mindset is, that neocons have to kind of build a case to these kind of people, and they're people who are by nature misogynist, anti-Semites, fearful of people different than themselves, anti-homosexual. So the religious right had to be constructed in a way to appeal to that mindset and to that block of voters. So that's why that was part of why the issues were chosen and how they were presented and the propaganda around them.
Now, we can't talk about this whole issue of the forming of this religious right without dealing with the really big thing that comes up every time around Catholicism, which is, and you spent quite a bit of time on this in your book, the sex abuse scandal, because that had to be, you know, can you tell people how the Catholic Church actually resolved this contradiction? I'm sure, you know, because, you know, you can talk about Swaggart getting caught with prostitutes and the guy out in Colorado, I can't remember his name now, and that Colorado Springs that was recently caught, you know, with gay prostitutes and, you know, but there's all this, but then there's this whole scandal, this sex abuse scandal that just racked and rocked the Catholic Church. And I think it has to do with even some of these other questions that you're bringing up here, but how, can you talk about how they dealt with that and the impact of that?
Well, how the neo-Catholics dealt with it was, first of all, to try and describe it as a homosexual issue, that once they rid the seminaries of homosexuals, the problem would go away. So that was the first thing, was to scapegoat homosexuals. The second thing was, and it appeals to the same mindset, is that you're always being persecuted. The Catholic Church is being persecuted by the secular press. The Church is being persecuted by the world, by the irreligious and atheistic world. So that was how they framed the issue to their own people, to their own parishioners and supporters.
Yeah, and it's just amazing. I mean, the depth to which they sink, and it's it's like incredible. I mean, even blaming the victims, you know, these little boys are too tempting, okay? You know, it's like...
That's right. They actually accused children of tempting priests.
Yeah.
But the point is that it's not so much what the priest did, although, I mean, most people say, well, those are sick people, really sick people. It was the cover-up by the bishops that really has upset the whole world. I mean, Catholics all over the world are upset with the hierarchy's reaction to what happened, not especially what happened.
Now, frankly, you put this in the context of the culture wars that have been going on ever since the 60s. You know, these reactionaries have never been able to look at the 60s without attacking them. This is the heart of their culture wars, the 60s and the 70s, and what was unleashed then, and even talking about the licentiousness of that was unleashed in the 60s and 70s and how it impacted the church's ability to recruit priests who were free of homosexual tendencies, as if the problem is that people's sexual orientation somehow is equated with abuse of kids.
That's,
you know,
right.
It's just, oh.
It's mind-boggling, yeah. but they accomplished it. They did it, in fact, that even the mainstream media refers to it as the majority of victims were boys. To this day, they say the majority of victims were boys, and that's just simply not true. I mean, well, The majority of victims were males, true, but they weren't teenage boys. I mean, the median age of the victims was 12.6 years old.
And again, this book, The Neo-Catholics Implementing Christian Nationalism in America, I really recommend it. I learned so much out of this. And one of the things I learned is that none of this came very easy in a certain sense. On one level, you think, okay, yes, they did in terms of the halls of power and reaching into Bush and the rest of them. And but in doing this, on the one hand, they had this ability to reach into the halls of power. On the other hand, they had to carry out a certain amount of purging within the ranks of the church, which I found to be very, very interesting. Purging and a demand for strict obedience, the demand for absolutism and a fight against relativism. And it was really very interesting how they actually went about cleaning out the dissenters in the church.
Well, that was accomplished through the papacy of John Paul II. Every bishop in the entire world is selected through the Vatican. So the only way to change the church in any country is to change the episcopate, and the only one that can change the episcopate is the Vatican. People fondly remember the civil rights movement being led with Catholic priests and nuns, and the anti-nuclear movement being led by Catholic bishops. Well, that all changed when John Paul II became pope, and as each bishop retired or died, he replaced it with one of his own men who would be sympathetic to the American neoconservative cause. So that's how it's really a 180-degree turnaround of the church in America.
Now, we're running up on our time, Betty, but I had a couple of quick questions, and there's so much more to talk about. I mean, you know, the idea that a lot of this came together around Reagan and then moved on, but really took full bloom with Bush.
So absolutely.
So go ahead and talk about that.
Well, that was the goal. I mean, I have a section in the book called Mission Accomplished, which it was. In other words, the whole point of the religious right was to elect someone like George Bush that would put a big vacuum cleaner over the country and suck up all the money into the pockets of his cronies and wealthy people. And that's, in fact, what has happened.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention the same thing in terms of really welding together. I mean, I do think this idea, this thing about the theocracy and the goal of this religious right for the institution of a theocracy, and again, this is related to our upcoming segment, this whole point of conquering the world and building a world, a theocratic world. You think about who they have here, the millions and millions, tens of millions of people that they are trying to weld together into a force of people who are trained in absolutism, in non-thinking, in know-nothingism, and fighting for God's greater glory. This is a very, very intense, intense movement. And I think that welding the Catholics into that and all that they brought to this, including their international connections and through the papacy and whatnot, has been really, really important to look at, examine, and turn people onto so they're aware of what's going on.
Well, it is. I mean, who in fact runs the world? It's multinational corporatism that has the big bucks. I mean, who else has the kind of money to implement these kind of things?
I do have to say, too, that I thought one thing, and we won't be able to talk about this, but it was very interesting, the fact that when you titled the book Implementing Christian Nationalism in America, and I have to say, I hadn't thought about this before, but I was really kind of just hit me in the head when you detailed the difference between Rome and the papacy and under, I guess, John Paul II and the Catholic hierarchy, the neo-Catholics in the U.S. around the U.S. war on Iraq. It seemed to be a point where this movement came into its own as a force tied to Rome and needing Rome, but actually much more tied to and part of the rise of Christian nationalism in America.
That's right. What else is the biggest example of the hypocrisy of the whole movement? I mean, you're going to demonstrate and do everything you can to protect fetuses, but not Iraqi children? I mean, that sums up the whole hypocrisy of neo-Catholicism.
Right. All right, Betty, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, and okay. I thank you for having me.
Sure. And the book is The Neo-Catholics Implementing Christian Nationalism in America. It's put up by Clarity Press, and it's by Betty Claremont. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Betty Claremont about her book, The Neo-Catholics Implementing Christian Nationalism in America. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with David Heilbroner, one of the directors of this killer new film, Waiting for Armageddon.
Sleep too big to miss. I got
All right, that's Armageddon by the Alkaline Trio and taken from their album From Here to Infirmary. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate.
David Heilbroner is a Harvard graduate, a former Manhattan prosecutor who's been making documentary films for more than 10 years. And together with Kate Davis, he's directed and produced Transgender Revolution, Life After Death Row, The Dark Side of Parole, Anti-Gay Hate Crimes, and Untying the Straitjacket for A&E, and produced and directed many other things. And I'm really happy to welcome him to the show today because he was one of the directors of a film that I've watched twice so far and still am chilled to the bone by what I learned. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Why don't you tell people what your film is about?
All right. It's about 50 million Americans, Christian evangelicals, who are fixated on the literal truth of the Bible as a roadmap to the end of the world, which they see, many of them see, in hints of happening right now in Hurricane Katrina, in the war in Iraq. And this same group, at the same time that they're fascinated with the end of the world, they see Israel and the Jewish people in particular playing roles up until the very last act, up until the Battle of Armageddon. And so the film takes you into the mindset of these people, and you hang out with them and travel to Israel with them, and we have sort of almost like visionary sequences of what they see the world, the end of the world, to be like. So that's, you know, that's an overview of the film.
Well, you know what? How about if I run some of the trailer from the film?
Go for it, man.
I think that would be very good. So why don't we turn through the trailer now and let people get a sense of what Waiting for Armageddon is all about.
At that instant, at 1/64th of a second, boom, just like that, everybody who's trusted in Christ as Savior will be caught up together to be with Him in the clouds.
If there's only 50 million, they'll suddenly vanish from this earth, off of elevators, off of escalators, out of offices, and out of cars on freeways and crashes and out of airplanes. The world would be terrorized.
Rapture makes me have to focus because I may meet my maker tomorrow.
You know, there's going to be a last battle. Israel is going to be attacked from the north, from the west, from the east.
Jerusalem will become a place of horror for the nations. I mean, it will be a horrible time for the Jews because the anvil on which the human race seems to be crushed is Israel.
And then you head south, I believe, to Jerusalem. And I think that's where the battle occurs, not here at Armageddon.
A real quick word of prayer before anybody comes up. We can have an international incident, okay?
Yes.
Lord, we do thank you for your grace, your goodness that you care about.
There's no place for that mosque. It has to be removed.
These are pictures that are inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You can dicker with them.
When people think that they have to possess a place to possess the truth, that turns that spot into the blasting cap of religious conflict.
I kept hoping one of Saddam's missiles would find its way over to the dome.
Iran Shiites are, for me, much more dangerous than those Texan evangelicals. But together, they may lock into something really destructive.
They hate us because it's their religious duty to hate us. They hate us because radical Islam is a doctrine of death.
Armageddon theology, this interest in war, seems to have an almost addictive power.
The war in Iraq is a good thing for Christians. The prophetic signs, they're increasing, just like the birth contractions of a woman.
World War III has started.
All right, David, that's the trailer for your film, Waiting for Armageddon. And I think it gives people a very good sense of what we're talking about here. A quick question for you. I mean, what you present in this film is one of the reasons it's so chilling. And I do have to compliment you on not losing your head in this and being able to actually present these people in a way that, you know, it's not compassionate, but it's objective. And the fact that you're sitting there and you're looking at these people who could be Joe whoever running the hardware store in, what do you know, Kentucky, and yet they're getting ready for the rapture. They're talking about whether or not they're going to be, they should pay attention to their lawn because they may be raptured out of here in a week.
You know, going meeting people who believed in the rapture, when I first went out to interview people, you know, I was really, frankly, I was embarrassed to ask. I was like, because it seems like such a, you know, you get sucked out of your clothes and be in the clouds watching the world, you know, literally watching Jesus wreak havoc upon the world. And it seems like a pretty far-fetched thing. You know, it's like Jonah and the whale. It's a good story, but do you really literally believe it? And the first couple that you see in the film, is this, they're not just Joe the hardware store. These are two jet propulsion engineers, right? The husband was an atheist, and he now believes that the Bible is, you know, like a manual. He sees it as like a computer manual, that if you just understand the language, you know, you're in, that you understand how the world's going to end. So, and they said, yeah, I said, how do you feel about the rapture? And they said, well, we could be raptured out of our clothes during this interview. You know, and I'm going, this guy gets up the next morning and designs jet engines. Pretty much things in my mind, yeah.
Not to mention, you probably tightened your belt and tied your shoes tighter. I don't want to be raptured out of my clothes. Okay, it'd be embarrassing for everybody.
Yeah, well, there you go, man. Some of us look better during the rapture than others. It's that mindset that's around that it's fun to talk about the rapture and joke around about it. There's a ton of these books, the best-selling books by Tim LaHaye, the Left Behind series. You know, the people who don't get raptured, what happens to them? They're some of the best-selling fiction books. Period. Not just of religious fiction. They sold 70 million copies.
That raises the question. I mean, that's the thing. Is some days it's easy to laugh at this, but actually, you know what? It isn't funny, because these people, one of the things that comes out about the people that you have in your film is they are really, really dedicated, bloodthirsty, committed to bringing about God's judgment and God's kingdom, no matter what it takes. And they actually talk with glee about watching this battle. You know, this.
Yeah, I mean, there's one this lovely, it's really a weird contradiction, but this very intelligent, a couple of PhDs, Wayne House, who leads tours through Israel. He's sitting there telling us, he said, you know, we always used to hope that one of Saddam's missiles would get off target and strike the Dome of the Rock and destroy it, because that would hasten things along. And, you know, these are actually decent people who consider, you know, the Christian ethics really part of their life, and at the same time they talk about death and destruction as if it's no big deal. And it's so weird, but these guys are organized. They're politically very, very active. They control radio stations all around the world. So it's one of the reasons that we made the film is because, you know, they get laughed at in maybe, you know, in New York City, in L.A., but they're, you know, they're running school boards in Kansas. You know?
Right, right. And even more importantly, they represent a very significant force and allied with a very, 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 very dangerous part of the U.S. ruling class. I mean, this is, you know, look, the whole Christian fascist movement united with this, the Bush segment of the ruling class, all of this stuff, this has not disappeared. And these people are still out there plowing up the ground and sowing their seeds and mobilizing this force. Let me remind people that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with David Heilbrunner, one of the directors of a great new film, Waiting for Armageddon. And now, David, one of the things, though, you know, when I was talking about this, of having this, you know, the alliance between them and the halls of power, which is very, very heavy. I mean, it never struck me as much as it did seeing in your film the point about Reagan. And here you have Reagan, who had his finger on the nuclear trigger, and he's talking about the fulfillment of prophecies.
That was, you know, one of the things, you know, being a documentary filmmaker, half your job is going out and interviewing people to find out what's going on in the world right now. The other part is, like, you look for archival footage, you know, what's really out there in the vault of NBC. And we found, this is one of those moments of documentary gold. Reagan is being interviewed by ABC, an ABC anchor, during the 1984 presidential debates. Okay, this is not some off-the-cuff remark. And they said, you know, Mr. President, you've been quoted as believing that you believe in the Battle of Armageddon. Do you think we're headed for a nuclear Armageddon? And Reagan goes off saying, yeah, the theologians say that the prophecies are coming together. And he says, we don't know whether Armageddon is going to be tomorrow or in 1,000 years, but the idea is he's sure it's going to come. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's chilling to have a president say, yeah, the theologians have got me convinced that Armageddon is on its way. I don't think you can get away with that. I think the religious right has gotten more sophisticated. You know, you can't catch George Bush saying that anymore. You can't catch Dick or even speaking to their constituency about that. But it's the mindset is there. And just as a political point, these guys aren't going away. They may have lost this last election, but they regroup, they rethink. They come back stronger. You haven't heard the last of them, that's for sure.
Right, exactly. And when you look at it, I was thinking about this point that Mel White makes in your film, and then you move over to this, I don't know if I'll say his name right, but Hagee. Okay, and what he talks about in terms of this, putting this in terms of the bigger political picture, this is a man who says World War III has started. He's waging war against what he calls Islamofascism, and he's even advocated attacks on Iran and this defense of Israel. This is a major political movement that we better be aware of.
Yeah, Hagee backed John McCain. McCain finally had to cut ties with Hagee because he had called the Catholic Church the Great Whore of Babylon, which doesn't play that well politically. But Hagee the film sort of crescendos with this passionate, fiery sermon he gives at this meeting of Christian evangelical leaders. And Hagee is immensely powerful for listeners who don't really know who he is. He has a 25,000-member megachurch in Corpus Christi, Texas. He had weekly meetings at the Bush White House. He's loved in Israel. Ehud Olmert used to welcome him. He has an organization called Christians United for Israel. He's just a powerhouse, and he's all over the country, and if not the globe. A figure to watch if you care about evangelical politics. Check out John Hagee.
Actually, if you care about humanity.
I guess I should put in a plug for our website, which is www.waitingforarmageddon.com. You know, the minute we put that trailer up on YouTube, I think it got like 20,000 hits within a fairly short order. So there's, people want to know about this stuff.
Yeah, and you've done a remarkable piece of work here, man. I really have to thank you guys. This is... I think beyond what you even may consider now as the importance of this, it's really important that people learn about this.
Yeah, and we tried to do it in a way that's really entertaining, because you get political films that are either too strident or too boring. We tried to, we tried to put you in the mindset of what it's like to anticipate the end of the world.
to live for it, actually. I mean, these guys are living for it. David, we have to wrap up right now, but I wanted to thank you very much for joining us today. And the film is Waiting for Armageddon. It's just a really remarkable film. You're going to watch it, and then you're going to have to find a way to warm your bones again, find a way to get your hair to calm down again. Do not miss this film. If it plays in your area, go and see it. If not, check out First Run Futures. That's a DVD distribution company. And pick up a copy for yourself and show it. Sound that alarm far and wide. David, thank you very much.
Hey, Michael. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us.
Okay, take care now.
All right, man. Bye.
That wraps up another edition of The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, and my production assistants, Henry Carson and Age. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And remember, each week we make the same point, and each week I feel it even more. The world does indeed cry out. It desperately needs, it cries out for radical, even revolutionary change. We, as human beings, not only need a whole new world, we deserve a whole new world. But whether or not we get that world depends on what we do. I'm Michael Slate, and if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a piece that I think fits the entire program. It's from Taj Mahal and his album Senor Blues, and it's called It's Getting Crazy Up In Here.
crazy.